morning. It's Wednesday, December 21st, 2005. This is the KBOO Morning News.
I'm Carlos Chavez.
And I'm Chris Andre. Coming up on the program, Congressman John Conyers has introduced a motion to censor Bush and Cheney for misleading Congress into war. Research shows that more than one in three American adolescents are physically unfit, and many the risk factors of heart disease. And Dick Cheney says Bush has the right to spy on U.S. citizens. Weather for today calls for rain and temperatures reaching the mid-40s. The time is 7 a.m.
Two-thirds of Portland's drinking water is an easy target for a shaky earth, nefarious vandals, or a bloated river, according to the Oregonian. Two pipes that help carry water to 800,000 people in the Portland region cross the Sandy River on an 1890s bridge that lacks required earthquake reinforcements. The pipes cross the river so close to a public bridge that engineers fret they could be a terrorist target. The city of Portland wants to fix that. Today, the city council will vote on seeking a $3 million federal grant to help bury the pipes under the Sandy River to reduce risk of damage. Randy Leonard says he wants the staff to spend more time on such projects as securing Portland's water pipes than wading into political quagmires, such as last year's failed attempt to cover the city's open reservoirs. The city has examined burying its water pipes at the Sandy River crossing since 1998. A 2000 study identified the crossing as one of the system's weakest links.
Drinking water may have a lot more in it than just H2O and fluoride, according to an environmental group's analysis of records in 42 states. A survey by the Environmental Working Group, EWG, released yesterday, found 141 unregulated chemicals and an additional 119 for which the Environmental Protection Agency has set health-based limits. Most common among chemicals found were disinfection products, nitrates, chloroform, barium, arsenic, and copper. The research and advocacy organization compiled findings from the states that agreed to provide data they collected from 1998 to 2003. That data comes from nearly 40,000 water utilities serving 231 million people. The utilities were required by federal law to report that data to consumers. 19 of those chemicals exceeded EPA unenforced safety guidelines for tap water systems serving at least 10,000 people. EWG's vice president for research said the group's findings show that the United States allows millions of people to be exposed to some chemicals for which the EPA either has never considered the risks or, if it has no enforceable limits. The top 10 states listed in order of the most contaminants in their drinking water were California, Wisconsin, Arizona, Florida, North Carolina, Texas, New York, Nevada, Pennsylvania, and Illinois. The biggest sources are agriculture, industry, and urban and sprawl development.
A Portland man has been accused by more than 50 investigators in three of his venture capital funds of fraud and misappropriating $33.5 million. For more than two decades, Berkman enjoyed unrivaled access to Oregon's political and business elite. In a lawsuit filed today in Multnomah County Circuit Court, the investors accused Berkman of running a complex fraud by using millions of dollars they invested in his funds to repay pre-existing debts. Berkman also put much of their money into companies Berkman controlled or had a significant personal interest in without disclosing the conflict of interest, the lawsuit alleged. Berkman is the former state Republican Party chairman who ran unsuccessfully for his party's gubernatorial nomination in 1994. The lawsuit says only $15 million remains of the $75 million invested in the three funds. Of the missing amount, $33.5 million was converted to improper use.
Researchers at Northwestern University say that more than one in three American adolescents are physically unfit and have many of the risk factors for heart disease. This according to Reuters. Treadmill tests performed on 3,100 adolescents revealed 34% were in bad physical shape. This figure was conservative because some couldn't participate due to the risk they might suffer a heart attack during the exam. In a sign of how the problem is getting worse, 1 in 8 adults aged 20 to 49 who performed the treadmill test were also physically unfit. Those who did poorly on the treadmill also tended to have high levels of so-called bad cholesterol in their blood, low levels of good cholesterol, high blood pressure, and large waists, although some out-of-shape subjects were thin. Projecting the results to the entire U.S. population means 7.5 million adolescents and 8.5 million adults are in a bad physical shape and at risk for cardiovascular disease and other illnesses such as diabetes.
The poor will have to pay a greater portion of their health care under spending cuts moving through Congress. The House has signed off on a compromise bill that would trim federal spending overall by $40 billion over the next 5 years. The Senate vote is expected to be so close that Vice President Dick Cheney was called back to Washington in case he's needed to break a tie. Under the compromise measure, states would have the option of charging premiums and increasing co-pays for Medicaid recipients. The Congressional Budget Office has concluded that such increases would lead many poor people to forego health care or not to enroll in Medicaid at all. This, in turn, would contribute to some of the nearly $5 billion in Medicaid savings over the next 5 years. The House bill voted for the higher fees, and they were part of the compromise bill approved over the weekend by House and Senate negotiators. Provisions related to drug manufacturers and insurance companies were largely scaled back. In a letter to Senate Majority Leader Bill Frist, the AARP said the bill does not ask for a shared sacrifice. The AARP said rather it protects the pharmaceutical industry, the managed care industry, and other providers at the expense of low-income Medicaid beneficiaries and Medicaid beneficiaries who foot the bill. The Congressional Budget Office estimates that higher copays, premiums, and a reduction in benefits for some participants will save the federal government $16 billion over 10 years. Most of the savings come from a reduction in services rather than an increase in revenue as a result of the higher payments. The higher payment from the poor do have supporters. The nation's governors believe that one way to slow Medicaid spending is to require beneficiaries to take on more personal responsibility in the purchase of their health care. The effort to reduce spending also would make it harder for the people to transfer assets and then to qualify for Medicaid coverage of their nursing home care. A spokeswoman for the trade group representing drug manufacturers said it would have no comment concerning the proposed legislation until the Senate votes on it.
New York City's 33,000 transit workers went on strike yesterday, leaving millions of residents to rethink their daily commute. A judge promptly slapped the union with a $1 million a day fine, and the 33,000 members are already facing individual fines of 2 days' pay for every day they are on strike. Rebecca Miles reports.
In contract negotiations that went to the wire, the executive board of the Transport Workers Union voted 28 to 10 early this morning to reject the Metropolitan Transit Authority's latest contract offer and declare the city's first transit strike in 25 years. The TWU contract expired on Friday at midnight, and a partial strike affected two private bus lines in Queens, with workers walking off the job, affecting 50,000 riders. Even with the MTA dropping its demand to raise the retirement age to 62 from 55, they insisted that future transit workers pay 6% of their wages towards their pensions. Roger Toussaint, president of the Local 100 of the Transport Workers Union, said, "This is a fight over whether hard work will be rewarded with a decent retirement. This is a fight over the erosion or the eventual elimination of health benefits coverage for working people in New York." Commuters stayed at home, walked, travelled by ferry or biked. Those commuting by vehicle were restricted to a maximum of 4 per car to enter Manhattan, and commercial vehicles were not allowed to enter Manhattan at 96th Street at all. And Wall Street investment companies chartered buses for their employees. Mayor Michael Bloomberg has estimated the strike would cost the city $400 million a day. For Free Speech Radio News, I'm Rebecca Miles reporting.
Jack Abramoff, the Republican lobbyist under criminal investigation, has been discussing a plea bargain with prosecutors. The deal would grant him a reduced sentence in exchange for testimony against former political and business associates. Abramoff is believed to have extensive knowledge of what prosecutors suspect is a wider pattern of corruption among lawmakers and congressional staff members. One participant in the case described him as a unique resource. What began as a limited inquiry has broadened into a far-reaching corruption investigation. Prominent party officials, including the former House Majority Leader Tom DeLay, are under scrutiny involving trips and other gifts from Abramoff and his clients. The case is sowing anxiety throughout Republican Party ranks. Abramoff has also been under investigation in connection with his lobbying. No charges have been brought against him in that inquiry. The existence of what amounts to two separate but overlapping investigations partly explains why the plea negotiations for Abramoff have been so protracted.
Raw Story is reporting that ranking House Judiciary Democrat John Conyers has introduced a motion to censor President Bush and Vice President Cheney for providing misleading information to Congress in advance of the Iraq War, failing to respond to written questions, and potential violations of international law. The resolutions were quietly introduced Sunday evening, along with a third resolution, H.R. 635, to create a select committee to investigate the administration's intent to go to war prior to congressional authorization. The committee would also be charged with examining manipulation of pre-war intelligence, thwarting congressional oversight, and retaliatory attacks against critics as part of the resolution. House Judiciary Democrats seek also to explore violations of international law as pertaining to detainee abuse and torture of prisoners of war. The Select Committee seeks to subpoena the President and other members of the administration in hopes of ascertaining if impeachable offenses have been committed. Republicans are not expected to support a select committee, nor are they expected to approve censure motions. House Resolution 636 seeks to censor the President for failing to respond to repeated questions for information on pre-war intelligence, possible war crimes against detainees, and violation of international law, and retaliatory action against critics of the administration. House Resolution 637 seeks censure of the Vice President for the same alleged abuses of power and failure to respond to repeated requests for information and testimony.
One of the 11 judges on a special court overseeing government surveillance has quit the panel. The Washington Post reports U.S. District Judge James Robertson is concerned about legal problems with President Bush's secret authorization of a domestic spying program that sidestepped warrants. He also repeatedly is concerned Bush's move may have tainted the work of the court he resigned from. The newspaper quotes two of Robertson's associates. Robertson stepped down from the special court in a letter late Monday to Chief Justice John Roberts. He did not resign his parallel position as a federal district judge.
California Senator Barbara Boxer has asked four presidential scholars for their opinion on whether President Bush's authorization of the National Security Agency to conduct surveillance on U.S. citizens is an impeachable offense. This comes as the Republican chair of the Senate Judiciary Committee, Arlen Specter, says he doubts the president acted within the Constitution. Mitch Jezrich has this update from Washington.
Over the weekend, former counsel to President Richard Nixon, John Dean, said that President Bush's acknowledgement of authorizing the NSA to conduct surveillance on U.S. citizens makes him the first president to admit to an impeachable offense. The statement has spurred Democratic Senator Barbara Boxer of California to write to four constitutional scholars asking for their advice of whether Bush's action is, in fact, impeachable. In a written statement, Boxer said she is expecting a full airing of the matter in congressional hearings next year. Meanwhile, White House spokesperson Scott McClellan maintains that the president acted within the law.
The president made a commitment to the American people that he was going to use every constitutional and congressional authority needed to fight and win this war on terrorism. This tool has been very successful in helping us to detect and prevent attacks from happening.
But the Republican chair of the Senate Judiciary Committee, Arlen Specter of Pennsylvania, puts doubt on whether the president was within his right.
I am skeptical of the Attorney General's citation of authority, but I'm prepared to listen. It's hard to see how the resolution on the use of force could be extended to the conduct involved here. And when he cites constitutional authority as commander-in-chief with a description that is plenary, which means absolute and unlimited, that's not consistent with the separation of powers under the Constitution.
The president also maintains the administration has consulted with Congress on the NSA's broadened authority at least a dozen times. One of the lawmakers who did know of the program is the ranking Democrat on the Senate Intelligence Committee, Jay Rockefeller of West Virginia. Rockefeller says he was only one of four lawmakers to know. Late Monday, Rockefeller released a letter he wrote to Vice President Dick Cheney in 2003 about his concerns of the program. Rockefeller says he was under order not to tell anyone, but now he's speaking out, in particular against the president's assertion that Congress has been involved.
I have long maintained that the White House uses, and the intelligence community to some degree, uses the so-called Gang of Four concept as a way of imparting information to you which may or may not be important, but which in any event completely gags you. You can't even tell your chief of staff on the Intel Committee, Intelligence Committee. You can't discuss it with anybody for as long as you live.
In the 1970s, Congress acted to bar the NSA's ability to conduct domestic surveillance without an order from a FISA court after it was learned it was spying on civil rights and anti-war organizers. Professor Christopher Pyle worked with the congressional committee that investigated the NSA in the 1970s. Pyle is now a professor at Mount Holyoke College in Massachusetts.
The problem in 1978 was that the executive branch was claiming an unlimited power to spy on Americans, the same argument that's being raised today by Attorney General Gonzalez, that the president is commander-in-chief or his chief executive may spy on anybody at any time, and that Congress may not restrain him. Faced with those arguments, Congress had no choice but to enact the Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Act and to make that the exclusive method by which the president could conduct electronic surveillance.
Pyle also says he agrees with the statement made by former Nixon counsel John Dean that Bush has admitted to an impeachable offense. For Free Speech Radio News, I'm Mitch Jezerich in Washington.
Vice President Dick Cheney yesterday called for strong and robust presidential powers. Cheney said executive authority was eroding during the Watergate and Vietnam eras. Some lawmakers objected that President Bush's decision to spy on Americans to foil terrorists showed he was flexing more muscle than the Constitution allows. The revelations of Bush's four-year-old order approving domestic surveillance without court warrants has spurred a fiery debate over the balance of powers between the White House, Congress, and the judiciary. On Capitol Hill, senators from both parties said the role of Congress cannot be sidelined, even in wartime, even in a questionable war. Democrats said they were deeply troubled by the surveillance program and contended the president had no authority to approve it. Republicans said Congress must investigate whether Bush was within the law to allow the super-secret National Security Agency to eavesdrop without warrants on international calls and emails of Americans and others inside the United States with suspected ties to Al-Qaeda. Attorney General Alberto Gonzalez cites the authorization to use military force law. Congress passed the law and Bush signed it a week after the September 11th terrorist attacks. The administration believes that law lets the government avoid provisions of the 1978 Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Act.
One of the more puzzling mysteries of 9/11 is whatever happened to the flight recorders of the two planes that hit the World Trade Center towers. Now it appears that they may not be missing at all. Counterpunch has learned that the FBI has them. Flight recorders or black boxes are required on all passenger planes. The FBI states and also reported to the 9/11 Commission that none of the recording devices from the two planes that hit the World Trade Center were ever recovered. There has always been some skepticism about this assertion, particularly as two New York City firefighters, Mike Malone and Nicholas DeMasi, claimed in 2004 that they had found three of the four boxes and that the federal agents took them and told the two men not to mention having found them. The FBI denies the whole story. These devices are almost always located after crashes, even if they are not found in usable condition. Now, there is stronger evidence that something is amiss beyond the alleged non-recovery of all four of those boxes. A source at the National Transportation Safety Board says the boxes were in fact recovered and were analyzed by the NTSB.
The Knight Ridder News Service reports that fewer African Americans are joining the military, the trend likely to make it harder to keep the all-volunteer military at full strength. The percentage of African Americans among all those who signed up for active duty Army service fell from 24% in 2000 to 14% in 2005. That's the lowest percentage since 1973, when the draft ended and the all-volunteer military began. In the past, African Americans have enlisted at higher rates than their overall percentage of the U.S. population, which was 12.9% in the 2000 census. S. Douglas Smith, a spokesman for the Army Recruiting Command at Fort Knox, Kentucky, pointed out that recruiting is down, not just for African Americans, but for all groups. This year, the Army missed its recruiting goal by more than 6,600 new enlistees, the first time it has missed an annual recruiting target since 1999.
The U.S. Central Command has released figures that show a dramatic rise in the number of air raids carried out in Iraq, but the numbers have received little coverage in the U.S. media. This from Al Jazeera. According to figures provided by Central Command Air Force's Public Affairs Office, the monthly number of air missions, including refueling, the U.S. Air Force, Navy, and Marines flew in November is almost 1,500 compared to 1,100 for the month of September. The number of U.S. air raids increased particularly in the weeks leading up to last Thursday's election, from a monthly average of about 35 last summer to more than 60 in September and 120 or more in October and November. News reports and the public are focused mainly on ground action by the Army and Marines, but a variety of U.S. aircraft are carrying out attacks daily. The raids have included attacks using unmanned Predator aircraft armed with Hellfire missiles. At least five times this month, an unmanned Predator flown remotely by airmen at flight consoles at a base in Nevada has struck targets in Iraq. General Michael Mosley, the Air Force Chief of Staff, said last Tuesday that Predators were attacking targets in either Iraq or Afghanistan almost every day.
With recent elections in Iraq, the Bush administration continues to argue that things are going well in the occupied country. But as FSRN's David Enders reports from Amman, Jordan, many Iraqis would disagree.
Abu Muhammad is a Jordanian citizen living in Iraq who works as a driver, ferrying people between Amman and Baghdad. His family is in Baghdad, but he left prior to last week's national elections and shortly before a law was enacted preventing people from other Arab countries from traveling to Iraq. Traveling from Iran, Mohammed points out sarcastically, is still allowed.
I am just waiting for the borders to be open. My wife and kids are in Baghdad.
Bush has argued that the Iraqi economy is beginning to rebound and that electricity levels are rising. But just as such assertions made by coalition provisional authority head Paul Bremer were bold-faced lies, Iraqis say the same thing about Bush's recent remarks. Jassim Mohammed Ibrahim is also a driver from Baghdad. He spoke while a friend replaced the windshield in his car. It had been shot by American soldiers near Abu Ghraib 2 days ago, he said. Ibrahim said that the rise in gas prices, which was announced Monday and met by demonstrations around the country, would likely put him out of business.
The price has affected our work so much that all the money we make is being spent on fuel.
Ibrahim said the U.S. military regularly kills people traveling between Iraq and Jordan.
They killed a man I know a few days ago near the border. His name was Bassem al-Basari. They also killed a woman and her family. They do it all the time.
At Sayyid Zainab, a restaurant popular with Iraqis in downtown Amman, Khatayr Salman, a bus driver, said he saw little improvement in the situation and that inflation was forcing him to import goods from Jordan, a reversal of the pre-war situation.
We still use generators. In the past, we didn't have rations of cooking oil or cooking gas. I have begun buying fuel on the black market. If I go to fuel stations, I have to wait sometimes 3 or 4 days, and it's expensive.
Other men in the restaurant said Baghdad was only receiving 2 or 3 hours of electricity each day. "It's just propaganda," one man sighed in response to Bush's assertions. In Amman, I'm David Enders, reporting for FSRN.
Palestinians living in occupied East Jerusalem will be banned by Israel from voting in the January 25th parliamentary election, citing concerns that the Palestinian resistance group Hamas may gain power, Agence France-Presse reported. An official in Prime Minister Ariel Sharon's office said, on condition of anonymity, that they will not allow there to be any polling booths in Jerusalem for the Palestinian elections. Under pressure from the United States, Israel reluctantly allowed Palestinians in East Jerusalem to vote in post offices in January's presidential elections. Israeli officials have warned that the peace process will end if Hamas becomes the dominant political party. Hamas, which is contesting the election for the first time, is expected to make a strong showing in next month's election after gaining the majority of votes in the West Bank's municipal elections. Israel seized and then annexed East Jerusalem after the 1967 war, but the international community still considers the area home to almost 200,000 Palestinians as occupied territory. The Palestinian Information Minister condemned the Israeli decision and said the Palestinian Authority will cancel the election if Israel doesn't reverse its decision.
Brazilian health officials have launched an investigation after claims that at least 10 impoverished Brazilians from an Amazon village may have contracted malaria while being used as human guinea pigs during a study by an American university. This from The Guardian. The $1 million research project was funded by the National Institutes of Health and conducted by the University of Florida. It was being carried out in 3 villages in the Matapi River and the northern state of Amapá. It intended to study feeding patterns among mosquitoes over a 4-year period in order to help control malaria outbreaks. Brazil's medical council suspended the project last Wednesday following the allegations. Critics say villagers were manipulated into taking part in the project and that those who allegedly contracted malaria as a result of being used as bait were offered no medical treatment. The study's chief researcher, Robert Zimmerman from the University of Florida, denied the allegations. The Guardian had access to the 5-page consent form that participants were required to sign. One paragraph explains that they will be asked as volunteers to feed 100 mosquitoes on your arm or leg, while another says they will receive a normal salary for taking part. Dr. Zimmerman admitted that errors had been made when the project was submitted for approval in 2000. His representation had not mentioned that participants would be paid, a prohibited practice for foreign organizations working in Brazil. That's the KBOO Morning News for Wednesday, December 21st, 2005. Weather for today calls for rain with highs in the mid-40s. You're listening to KBOO at 90.7 FM in Portland, in Corvallis at 100.7 FM, on translator K264AA, and in Hood River at 91.9 FM on translator K220HR. You can log on to our website at kboo.fm. Our producer and engineer for this morning's newscast is Brian Smith. Our assistant producer is Chris Andre. The vacationing KBOO Morning News and Public Affairs Director is Kathleen Stevenson. I'm Carlos Chavez.
And I'm Chris Andre.
For later on today, at 7:30, Aaron Sexton Sailor, guest host Locus Focus Talk Radio. The topic is gay families. At 9, it's Veterans Voice with Northwest Vets for Peace. At 10, Andrew Geller hosts People Rise Up. He examines alternate explanations for why the World Trade Center Towers 1, 2, and 7 fell on September 11, 2001, since 2 government studies both concluded that fires did not cause the collapses. The guests are Don Paul and Jim Hoffman, co-authors of Waking Up from Our Nightmare, the 9/11 Crimes in New York City. And at 11, it's Democracy Now! With Amy Goodman and Juan Gonzalez. That's all right here on KBOO, your community non-corporate, volunteer-powered and listener-sponsored radio station. And be sure to catch the KBOO Evening News at 5 p.m. Thanks for joining us.